Right now we're going to be speaking to Diane Katz. It's, she's with the Mackinac Center for Public Policy. Again, the center's director of science, environment, and science policy. Let's go ahead and welcome Diane to the program. Good morning, Diane Katz. How are you today?
Good morning.
Thanks for being with me today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure.
You know, every time I think there's some common sense returning to government, there's just a hair maybe showing up here and there. I see things like the Democrats saying that they don't want to do that. Well, we can't say the global war on terrorism anymore because we might offend Al Qaeda. And then the thing that we're going to talk about today, which is the Supreme Court doing what I would suspect is more judicial activism, supporting the Clean Air Act and giving EPA new authorities to go smack us upside the head.
Well, it's one thing to read the Clean Air Act and interpret what the act actually says. It's quite another. For the court to substitute its opinion of what the act should do with what the act actually says. So this is a troubling ruling.
Very much so. Let's go over the details of it so everybody's familiar with exactly what happened, because I know some news reports didn't go into the detail like they probably should have. So what actually went on with this?
Well, the basis of the ruling was this. The court majority, and it was a 5-4 decision, the court majority concluded that the Clean Air Act requires the EPA to regulate carbon dioxide emissions from autos to avert global warming. And so that's the basis of the ruling. From a legal standpoint, it's very significant because it determines that EPA is in fact responsible for regulating these emissions, and that was something that the EPA had declined to do up to this point. Now, in practical terms, it'll be a very long time before we actually see the effects of this type of regulation. But, you know, what's most troubling about this is that the court has come to its conclusions based on some very faulty science. And, you know, there is a lot that is being said about global warming out there, much of it wrong. But for the highest court in the land to base its ruling on some of this faulty science is very disturbing. There's a long line of precedent that holds that courts, you know, typically defer to regulatory agencies on matters of policy. But in this instance, the court substituted its judgment for what the EPA should do, and that's ultimately substituting its judgment for the president's, because he runs the executive branch. Now, in terms of the science that EPA got wrong, the petitioners in this case included a number of environmental groups and the state of Massachusetts, and they claimed that the failure of the EPA to regulate these emissions was harming the state. They cited the erosion of shoreline, for example, caused by higher waters. So the EPA the court looked at what the petitioners said about global warming and concluded that it was in fact a serious threat. And there is a lot we don't know about global warming. And, you know, it's at this point, what we do know is that average global temperatures have risen about 1 degree Fahrenheit in the past century. But that's well within the normal range of what is naturally occurring or has occurred over time. And the court also concluded there is a, quote, strong consensus about the effects of global warming. But that's simply incorrect. Scientists don't agree on whether, you know, we know enough to link temperature changes with carbon dioxide levels. They don't agree on, you know, whether we can predict that future temperatures are going to rise significantly. And they don't agree, there's no consensus on what effect, you know, higher temperatures may have. In fact, there are some scientists who have concluded that higher temperatures can be more beneficial than harmful. So it's very faulty science on which to make, you know, a major regulatory decision.
Well, and, you know, and you look at what's naturally, as you mentioned, naturally occurring. I mean, global warming apparently is naturally occurring across the universe at times. There's a study, and it's very preliminary, so this could be faulty as well. So I don't want to sit there and give total credence, but I'd be curious to see what your thoughts are. You've probably seen it. That says that global warming hits Mars, too, with some of our Mars surveyors being able to tell differences in temperature loads and so forth.
Right. Temperatures have risen and fallen for long periods throughout, you know, the history of the planet. And this has occurred even as carbon dioxide levels have, you know, increased. And so what that tells us is that there is not a, you know, 100% correlation between higher carbon dioxide levels and higher temperatures, because in some cases there have been higher carbon dioxide levels and lower temperatures. And so, you know, this is the complexities of climate and climate change are enormous. You know, there are so many variables that go into effect, and, you know, a lot of what's been said about global warming is based on computer models. But these computer models, you know, are hardly foolproof. And, you know, in many respects, they're simply theoretical. It's very difficult to look at the temperature of the entire Earth and, you know, make claims about what's going to happen in Massachusetts.
Well, I know not only that, but one of the big things they mention even locally in Michigan as they talk about and across the country is that, well, the pollution and the carbon dioxide is causing all this ozone and so forth. Oh, my gosh. I mean, you could maybe they ought to come to northern Michigan around the latter part of April and May and get to see our ozone layer that comes across this area as things start warming up and so forth. For Pete's sake, ozone is a weather phenomenon.
Well, and, you know, a lot of the science being done doesn't adequately explain the effects of clouds, for example, on warming and greenhouse gases or particles in the air. I mean, there's so much that we don't understand yet. And so to impose on the nation, you know, very strict regulations that will prove very costly in the end is really putting, no pun intended, the cart before the horse.
Absolutely, it is. I've got to take a news break right now. Diane, can you hold on just a little bit?
Oh, sure.
All right, do appreciate it. Diane Katz is with she's the Center's Director for Science, Environmental, and Science Policy of the Mackinac Center for Public Policy. Diane Katz from the Mackinac Center for Public Policy is on the line with us right now. She's the Director of Science, Environment, and Science Policy for the Mackinac Center. In about 6 minutes, we'll do the Wall Street Journal report. We continue our conversation with Diane right now as we continue to look into this. You know, Diane, you mentioned that this isn't going to have, or at least sounds like it isn't going to have any short-term impact on rules and regulations and so forth, the Supreme Court ruling. So you don't think the EPA is going to feel emboldened to start digging into some things right away?
Well, the rulemaking process is long and complicated, and no doubt will be, you know, the source of yet more litigation. That's why I say I don't think in the short term we're going to have anything immediate. As it now stands, there do not exist any regulations relative to carbon dioxide from automobiles, and so the agency is going to have to go through an entire rulemaking procedure. One of the things that complicates this is that EPA, you know, has not been the agency that comes up with, you know, mileage and fuel efficiency standards, and this is going to put the agency in a bit of a different role in terms of regulating carbon dioxide emissions. So I think this is going to be a very drawn-out and costly exercise.
Did it surprise you that this Supreme Court went this direction? It didn't me. I mean, we're being left with the impression that there's a much more conservative Supreme Court here, that they don't get into a lot of judicial activism like they do. At least that was the hope of some of these appointees, but...
Well, I think, you know, there's the perception that it's a more conservative court. There are some conservative members on the court, but certainly there have been a string of rulings, this one, the one relative to property rights and the use of eminent domain, that counter that perception. You know, again, I cannot emphasize enough that what is most stunning to me about this ruling is the the court's reasoning that EPA must act because there's a consensus that global warming poses an imminent threat. I mean, you know, proponents of regulation keep repeating to us that there's a consensus among scientists, and they say it often and loud in hopes that it becomes true simply by the, you know, the repeating. But the facts tell us otherwise. And, you know, there have been recent surveys of climatologists about their opinions and thoughts on global warming. And, for example, you know, a recent one found that only 9.4% of the respondents strongly agree that climate change is a result of man-made sources. And then about the same percentage disagree with that. And almost 23% of respondents strongly agreed that the UN reports reflect a consensus within, you know, climate science. And so, you know, there's an enormous variability in opinion about global warming and its effects.
Well, yeah, even the UN reports themselves that Al Gore quotes in his movie An Inconvenient Truth is way off base, according to reports. I mean, the latest one I saw from the UN said that they expected it using their own data, which is very questionable, as you mentioned, said that the next 100 years expect a rise of 23 inches across the planet of ocean rise coming toward shorelines and coastal cities, whereas Al Gore quoted it as 23 feet.
You know, he belongs in Hollywood more than he does in the lab. But, you know, here's the thing with these predictions. That's all they are is, you know, you might as well sit down at the Ouija board at this point.
Because, that's really
you,
true.
You know, they're some of them, you know, and there are a lot of, don't get me wrong, there are a lot of scientists who are doing serious science on this and who, you know, perhaps are doing their best to predict what's going to happen in the future. But the tools that we have at our disposal, which are these computer models, really are not reliable. You know, there are just too many factors influencing it. But what we do know is that if you try to apply these models to the past climate record, they don't fit. In other words, they're not supported by the climate record. And so they're not very good as predictive tools. Why, you know, people want to believe that the Earth is about to end, you know, I frankly don't quite understand. I think, you know, there's more of a threat that we're going to scare ourselves to death, that we're going to be burned up by global warming.
I've got a theory on it that I'd like to throw by you, but I've got to do it after the Wall Street Journal report and we check on business. Can you hang on with that?
No problem.
Diane Katz is with us right now. She's the Mackinac Center for Public Policy. The Mackinac Center for Public Policy's Director of Science, Environment, and Science Policy on with us right now to talk about this really landmark Supreme Court decision that is going to force the EPA to regulate greenhouse gas emissions and set the agency and orders the agency to do so. We're talking to her about that right now. Diane, welcome back. I appreciate so much you being here today.
Thank you.
Diane, I've always sat here, and as I've watched the environmentalist movement over the years in various places I've lived and some of the goofiness they've come up with, and I could just name a whole massive list. You'd probably name even a bigger list of silliness that seems to come out. I mean, there seems like to be two kinds of people, one who care about the environment and the other who seems to be an environmentalist activist, and it seems like they're always two different kinds of human beings. And I say that only with this in mind. I mean, when you look at the kind of things they're trying to spread, the activist movement, it seems like more and more their faulty science, their foregone conclusions. You listen to them speak, and they end up saying, "Well, if we can assume this," and then the very next sentence say, "Since we know this is true," and sit there and play head games with everybody. The more I listen to it, the more I wonder if it's just something to be able to control the populace with. Because if you can change how we have to live, which is really what they want. I mean, I've read discussions from Al Gore that sits there and wants electric restrictors on houses that only can use 500 watts of power at a time and get rid of most people's vehicles and make us all live close to work in cluster developments, as they call it, which means out in cities so they can preserve the pristine out in the countryside from human infestation. I mean, when you see things like this, you've got to wonder that maybe the ultimate goal, and it may be way past their lifetime, is to actually control the populace and get back to a more feudal system, I mean, down the road. When you look at some of the long-term plans, 75 and 100-year-out plans that they're trying to accomplish.
Yeah, I see what you mean. I don't know that their end point, that is, that their goal is an enslaved population. But what I do see is that they have a conception of life, you know, of our society as one being run, basically, by a central government. And that, you know, they view government ultimately as being the best, you know, the best control for how we as society should be organized. And that's really pretty contrary to, you know, the democratic ideal on which this country was founded.
Yeah, I think so. You're absolutely right. It is. And it's just basically, and when you talk about a central government, you're talking about people being appointed. The populace doesn't know how to take care of themselves, and we know what's best for you.
Right. There's a lot of we know what's best for you involved. And it's rulings like these that, you know, highlight that reinforce that idea, and that's why it's dangerous. That's why it's, you know, it's something that all citizens ought to be concerned about, and it's particularly important when it comes to a scientific issue, because science should be able to tell us what's, you know, cause and what's effect, what's true, what's false, and as soon as we start you know, veering off that path, then we're not acting based on rationality. We begin acting on sort of whim. And when you begin acting on whim, and when you allow government to act on whim, that's how you end up with tyrannies.
Absolutely, it is. There's no doubt. Let me ask you, with that in mind, what can Congress do? Because obviously the executive branch's hands are tied. It would have to be legislative if anything can be done to change this to where and put the power back into the hands of elected officials instead of Supreme Court in this case, sir. Or is this thing so locked down we're stuck?
No, and you bring up a really excellent point. Part of the problem here is that Congress has a tendency to write laws that are very vague, you know, and that allow them to take credit for doing something without taking the blame for doing too much. And so what this does is, you know, these, like in the Clean Air Act, they will write a statute that leaves up to the regulatory agencies, you know, what rules are going to be in place and how those rules are going to be written. At this point in time, Congress certainly could enact a statute that says, you know, global warming does not pose an imminent threat at this point in time. You know, the EPA or any other regulatory agencies shall not regulate, and so on. And, you know, that's in Congress's power.
Now, the question is, will Congress actually do anything? You made a valid point when you talk about vague laws. I mean, when you sit there and see something passes with 20,000 pages, but yet, when you really read the entire thing, says nothing, it contradicts itself so much it isn't funny. And that's very normal in Congress. And you talk to the congressmen who tell you the vast majority of the time the legislators don't read the bills they're passing.
Yeah.
I mean, if they did, they would only be passing 10 to 12 bills a year.
That wouldn't be such a bad thing.
No, not at all. I think it would change the world, probably.
There are endless numbers of court cases. I mean, I couldn't even, you know, give you an estimate on, you know, on how to interpret specific language in some of these bills, and that have enormous repercussions for not only for the economy, but, you know, for our way of life. And certainly this is one of them. I mean, you know, certainly the court read, in my opinion, read more into the Clean Air Act than a plain reading would find there with respect to carbon dioxide. But there's enough wiggle room in the language that Congress used, you know, that they could get away with it.
So basically, it's tough to be able to write these things to where, or it's tough to put the effort out, I guess, is probably the better question, to actually write these things to where they are pretty ironclad.
Well, part of it is the political process. That is, you know, lawmakers or legislators want to please. And when you have competing interests, you know, one way to reach a compromise is to write things sort of, you know, vaguely. And I think that's how we get a lot of this. It's political, you know, it's a lack of political courage, basically.
Boy, I certainly agree with that. Hold that thought. Minutes right now, I'm talking to Diane Katz, who is the Director of Science, Environment, and Science Policy for the Mackinac Center for Public Policy. Diane, did you expect this ruling to come down like this at all? Was there anything that was leading you to saying, oh boy, here comes something, or was this just out of the blue smack in the head shocker on this?
I never guess what the court's going to do because I'm invariably wrong. You know, it's very difficult to know ahead of time how they're going to come down. And so I was surprised. What surprised me the most was the majority's sightings of really faulty science. That really stunned me, frankly. You know, I had expected would have hoped for a more careful reading on the part of the court about global warming and global warming science. And here's the tragedy of this. You know, the republic is not going to fall if we regulate, you know, auto emissions for carbon dioxide. It's not necessarily a good thing, but, you know, it's not going to destroy us. But what it does do is it misdirects enormous resources from more pressing environmental problems. I mean, there are real environmental problems out there that could be addressed. That pose a much more imminent threat both to public health and to the environment than global warming does. But what this type of judicial activism does is it skews those priorities and it diverts our attention and our money and our time and our efforts, you know, from more pressing environmental problems.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that, and that's probably on our list as long as our arm if we sat there and wanted to talk about it, too, and that's the frustration of it all. And plus, if you know, looking back at it, bringing it to a Michigan point of view, and that is the more regulation we put on these cars, especially something that is questionable at best as far as necessity goes, I mean, the more regulation, the more expensive they are, which means less cars sold, which takes us down the spiral of even a worse case than where we're at right now as far as economic situations here.
That's true, and the other irony is that to the extent that new cars become more costly, people will hold on to their old cars, and old cars are always more polluting than new cars. And so, you know, we can end up actually with worse pollution than we might have otherwise, at least in the short term.
I think that's very true. That's a very valid point that I'll bet a lot of people have forgotten about because cars over time start losing their catalytic systems. Let's face it, on a 15-year-old vehicle, it doesn't work the same as a new car by any stretch.
Right, right. And even new technology, you know, if there is a delay in getting it implemented, then, you know, we're losing the benefits of that new technology, but we're still bearing all of the costs of it.
Well, maybe somebody's going to come along and say the government ought to be giving us a donation so we can all buy new cars. Wait and see if that doesn't come. I mean, for Pete's sake, they're going to do it for television. So.
Well, yeah, there are a lot of subsidies out there that, you're right, that, you know, could buy people out on a number of things that, you know, they'd be better off than the regulation.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, well, that's a good, you know, we could talk about that forever. I mean, the war on poverty is a good one, a good example. We could have made everybody millionaires and all the money we spent on that kind of thing and all sorts of foolishness.
It's a good thing, though, that America is such a rich country. And
oh, it really is. We'd be bankrupt if it wasn't.
Right. But that's something that, you know, that brings up another point, which is that, you know, America gets blamed often for producing so many greenhouse gas emissions. But what people, you know, also have to keep in mind is that America produces so much. And what we produce in many ways benefits the entire world. And so, you know, if the cost of that is, you know, some greater amount of emissions, you know, the other side of the equation is the enormous benefit that the world derives from what we create.
Absolutely, and we need to be hanging on to that instead of just always feeling like we're the bad guy and we're so sorry. One of these days we ought to stand up and say, wait a minute, don't you? You better start appreciating what we're doing here, for Pete's sake.
Right. Yeah. Right. Exactly.
That's some good points. Hey, if we want to learn more about some of this, you've got some reports on the Mackinac Center's website, right?
We do, and I would encourage listeners to visit our website on this and other issues. It's www.mackinac.org. And there are a number of links to, dozens of articles and studies that the Mackinac Center has done on, this issue as well as any issue you can imagine. So it'd be great to have your listeners visit the website.
That sounds good. Diane Katz, thanks so much for being here. I really appreciate spending some time today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Hope you have a good day.
Thanks. You too. Bye.
That's Diane Katz.